hardy lookout and his one-time courtier. They had failed, and death was customarily the penalty for failure. Nor could he lament in any way the four foul corpses. Slaves were born to be sacrificed. But he was personally ashamed that one of his slaves had been so weak as to cry out merely because her man was being taken to Oro. Tamatoa looked upon a reasonable number of sacrifices as the simplest way of obtaining a steady flow of manna, but he nevertheless felt considerable uneasiness over the fact that the total of sacrifices for any given convocation had now been established as 9, plus more perhaps according to the chances of the day. Bora Bora was not a large island. Its men were numbered, and if in the past they had maintained their freedom, it was because of their superior courage. The king wondered, is this sudden conversion to Oro a device by the wise men of Hawaiki, whereby they can depopulate my island, and thus accomplish by guile what they have always been unable to do by battle? He was deeply perplexed by a further haunting possibility. Do you suppose the priests at Hawaiki are teasing our high priest along with promises of promotion, only until such time as he has disposed of Tororo and me? Then, for the first time, he expressed in words his real perplexity. It is very difficult to be king when the gods are changing. Tororo saw things more simply. He was outraged. His thoughts were forthright and purposeful. The death of slaves he could condone, for that was the law of the world on every island. But to execute for trivial reasons the best fighters on Bora Bora merely to appease a new god was obviously wrong and disastrous. Look at the body of Terupe, lying there between the shark and the turtle. He was the best steersman I ever had, and the high priest knew it. Antipoa, useless beside the shark. He was wise and would have made a good counselor. Tororo was so furious that he did not trust himself to look either at his brother or at the high priest, lest he uncover his thoughts. Instead, he contented himself with staring ahead at the impressive canoes and listening to the mournful drums speaking of death. He thought, unless we settle the high priest now, these drums are the requiem of Bora Bora. He saw clearly that the death of 8 or 10 more key warriors would lay the island open to assault. I'll work out a plan, he swore to himself. The minor priests looked with some satisfaction upon the sacrifices already consummated and those about to occur. With the advent of Oro, each priest had faced an inner struggle. Shall I go over to the new god, or shall I remain faithful to Tane? It was gratifying to know that one had chosen the winner. The priests acknowledged that there remained some dissidence in the island, but they had observed that after each convocation, adherence to Tane weakened. Sacrifices help us attract the attention of Oro, they rationalized. And then he sends us manna. Their conclusions were influenced, perhaps, by the fact that as priests, they could be reasonably sure that they would not be sacrificed to obtain manna. Their role in the upcoming ceremonies was simple and known: to hoist the sacrifices into place, to eat the sacrificial roast pig, also the boiled bananas, the baked taro, and the salted fish. And when the convocation ended, they had to throw the human bodies into the sacred pit. There was an exhilaration about Oro that other gods did not have, and they felt gratified that they had been among the first to join his side. The 30 rowers had only one thought. Will it be I? And the 3 remaining slaves had no thoughts. None, that is, that would have been remotely comprehensible to the non-slaves in the canoe. For curiously, these 3 men, even though each had known from birth that he was doomed, had exactly the same fears, the same sick feeling beneath their hearts, and the same unaccustomed sweat in their armpits, as did the men who were not slaves. But this would never have been believed. The palpitations of the slaves did not continue long, for on the instant that Tororo touched his canoe onto the beach of Hawaiki, the burly priest flashed his brutal club and killed first one, then 2, then three. Their bodies were pitched onto the runway up which the canoe was to be drawn, and soon every passenger who had come in the canoe, even the king and the high priest, bent himself to the hallowed task of hauling the mighty craft ashore and onto a small plateau where it would be consecrated for the coming year. At the precise moment when the canoe came to rest, the high priest whirled in the morning sunlight and dipped his staff toward one of Tororo's most trusted companions, and before the man could move, the awful club descended, and his skull was cleft in two. His body was strung from the stern to stand guard during the ceremonial days. The surviving crewmen, aghast at the rank of the man who had been slain, tried in deepest shame to prevent the thought that rose to their hearts. It was not I. The convocation was planned to last 3 days, during which no sound but the problems of priests should be heard. Assemblies took place in an extensive, roofless rock temple, perched on a magnificent plateau overlooking the ocean across which the participating canoes had come. It was a low, sprawling edifice, paved with blocks of black lava, from which even blades of grass had been swept. At one end, an inner temple, thatched with palm, had been constructed, and in it reposed the ark which housed the Holy of Holies, the ultimate statue of Oro. The exposure of this source god, the essential being of Oro himself, was so solemn an undertaking that not even kings or their brothers could witness the ceremony. They were excluded during the first august meeting when Oro was taken from his ark. There were, however, witnesses. From each canoe, the five human sacrifices had been hauled to the temple, plus five from Hawaiki itself, and had been stacked in a pile for Oro's approval. When, through his highest priest, Oro granted assent, the priest as man thinking, "It's impressive seeing so many bodies at once. Proves the islands are beginning to demonstrate their love for Oro." Lesser priests stepped forward and engaged in one of the convocation's most solemn rituals. With long bone needles threaded with golden sennit, they pierced the left eardrum of each corpse, thrust the needle on through the dead brain, and jerked the sennit out through the right ear. Then, fashioning a long loop, they strung each of the 60 corpses onto trees surrounding the temple, and for the succeeding hours these sacrificial men were free to gaze with dead eyes upon what not even kings could witness. Tamatoa was required to sit apart with his brother kings, absolutely silent for 7 hours, for spies supervised the kings to note any who failed in just homage to Oro. But in truth this was not necessary, for the 12 kings appreciated that their divinity derived from some august ultimate source beyond themselves, and their reservoirs of manna required constant replenishment through sacrifice and prayer. The world itself, in terrified silence, now paid reverence as manna flowed into both island statues and island kings. The temple grounds were not entirely silent, and had this fact been ascertained by spies, those who were secretly breaking the taboo would have been instantly sacrificed. But Tororo knew this, and for his hushed conversations with his 29 remaining crewmen, he had chosen a remote glade ringed by palms. "Are we willing to speak with frankness?" he asked. "What risk do we run?" a fiery young chief named Mato asked. "If we talk, they will kill us. If we remain silent..." He bashed his fist into his hand. "Let's talk." "Why should so many of our men be given to Oro?" another asked. Tororo listened to the complaints and then said, "I have been willing to run the risk of getting you here because it doesn't matter whether there's a spy among us or not." He stared at each of his men and continued, "If one of you is a spy, inform the high priest, because that will scare him from carrying out what I think is his plan. If no one betrays us, we're even better off." "What is your plan?" Mato from the north side of Bora Bora asked. Tororo held a small length of sennit, which he twisted and untwisted, saying slowly, I think the high priest intends to offer our king as a supreme sacrifice to Oro. He wants to impress the other priests with his control over Bora Bora. But he's got to give the signal himself, because if he kills by stealth, where would be his political advantage? So we must watch the high priest constantly. The young chiefs sat silent, because whatever Tororo divulged as his plan was bound to involve maximum danger. Then a lesser noble pointed out, "It isn't today we have to worry about." "That's right," Tororo agreed. "Today they're occupied." And he indicated the ghastly circle of dead men dancing in trees. "But what about the general meeting tomorrow?" Tororo untwisted the Senate and nodded judiciously. "If I were the high priest," he said, "with his plans, I'd strike tomorrow." Mato was in reckless mood, for during an awful moment that morning he had felt sure that the high priest was going to nominate him as the skull-split guardian of the canoe. He said sternly, "I think that if the priest even begins to point at Tamatoa, we must surround the king and fight our way to the canoe." "I think exactly the same thing," Tororo said abruptly. There was a long silence as the other 28 men contemplated what such a bold step involved. But before any could turn away in cowardice, Tororo threw down the Senate and spoke rapidly. "To succeed, we must ensure three things. First, we must somehow move our canoe to the top of the hill so that we can rush it into the water without cutting down our speed." "I'll take care of that," Hiro, the steersman, promised. "How?" "I don't know." Tororo liked his honest answer, but nevertheless pushed his face to within a few inches of the steersman's. "You know that if the canoe is not in position, we will all die." "I do," the young chief said grimly. "Next," Tororo said, "we must have two very determined men sitting on the rocks at the temple exit." "Bresh," Mato cried, "I'm one, and I want Pa for the other." A wiry, shark-faced man with no chin, Pa, the fortress, stepped forward and announced, "I'm the other." "You may not escape," Tororo warned them. "We'll escape," Mato swore. "Men of Hawaiki have never..." "The third requirement," Tororo said impatiently, "is that each of the rest of us be prepared to kill instantly anyone who moves toward Tamatoa." "We know the executioners," Pa growled. "And once we make a move, we must sweep Tamatoa up and with an unbroken rush get him to the canoe." He paused and then added softly, "It sounds dangerous, but once we are seaborne, wait for the west wind will be our safeguard." "They will never catch us," the steersman promised. "And if they did, what could they do?" Mato boasted. And as the men talked, it was apparent that all wished they were in the certainty of the canoe and not in the temple grounds of Oro, which were alien and unknown. "This will be the signal," Tororo said. "You will watch me, and the moment I move to defend the king, the steersman must dash for the canoe, and you men must see that he gets through the exit." "Who will disarm the executioner?" Mato asked. "I will," Tororo said coldly. Then, to inspire his men, he boasted, "No club will fall tomorrow swifter than my arm." The men appreciated this assurance, but Mato killed their ardor by stating, "There is one grave fault in this plan." "What?" Tororo asked. "Yesterday, before we sailed, Marama took me aside and said, 'My husband is sure that the high priest plans to kill the king, but I am certain that Tororo himself is the target.' I think your wife is right. What do we do if she is?" Tororo could not reply. He could see only his patient, worried wife moving among the men and listing their promises to protect him. He looked at the ground, recovered the Senate he had been twisting, and placed it in his belt. It was shark-faced Pa who spoke. "Marama spoke to me, too," he said, "and our duty is clear. If they strike at the king, everything goes as planned. But if they strike at Tororo, you, Mato, with your men, save the king, and I, with mine, will rescue Tororo." "I am not the important one," Tororo said honestly. To us, you are, his men replied. And they proceeded with their plans. But there was a mind at work that night, much keener than either Mato's or Pa's, and it belonged to the high priest. During the most solemn part of the convocation, he had been thinking. And when Great Oro was returned to the ark, the high priest called his assistants to him, and they sat cross-legged in a shadowy corner of the great temple, with the bodies of men dancing above them in the night air. "Have you noticed anything today?" he began. "Only that you are right," a young priest reported. "Tororo is our mortal enemy." "What makes you say that?" "As you directed, I studied him constantly. Four separate times I caught him struggling against the will of Oro, terrible be the name." "When?" "Principally when the king's courier was slain. He drew back markedly." "I thought so too," the high priest agreed. "And when one of his crew was sacrificed to guard the canoe." "He did?" "And it seemed to me that when it came time for Tororo to lead the king away from the temple, while we came in, he acted joyously rather than in sorrow." "We thought so too," several priests chorused. "But what confirms it is that this afternoon Tororo must have held some kind of meeting with his men." "Is that correct?" the high priest snapped. "I can't be sure, because, as you know, I had to leave him when we entered the temple. But immediately after Oro was returned to the ark, I slipped out to check on our men." "What did you find?" "Nothing. They had vanished." "How could they?" the high priest demanded. "I don't know, but they had vanished." "Was the king with them?" "No," the spy reported. "He sat properly with the other kings." "Can we be sure that Tororo held a meeting? If we were sure..." "I searched everywhere," the young spy insisted, "and in my own heart, I am sure." For a long time, the high priest contemplated this unwelcome news, fingering his staff and driving it into the ground. Finally, he mused, "If we could be certain that a meeting was held, we could eliminate the entire canoe. We would..." But when he weighed all consequences, he apparently decided against this, for he suddenly turned to his burly executioner and said softly, "Tomorrow, I don't want you at any time to stand either near the king or near Tororo. Keep completely away. You, Rariao," and he addressed his spy, "are you as swift of club as you once were?"
"I am."
"You are to place yourself inconspicuously so that at an instant signal you can kill Tororo. You are to watch him constantly. If he makes even the slightest move, anything."
"Do I wait for a signal from you?" Rariao asked.
"No, but as you strike, I will point at him, and his dead body will be sacred to Oro." The high priest moved on to discuss their roles with others, but he soon returned to Rariao and asked, "You understand? You don't wait for a signal. You kill him if he moves."
"I understand."
The high priest concluded his meeting with a long prayer to Oro, at the end of which he told his men, "One way or another, tomorrow we'll see Bora Bora finally delivered to Oro. The old gods are dead. Oro lives." His assistant priests breathed deeply with excitement, for their struggle to implant their new god on the backs of Tane and Ta'aroa had not been easy, and for several months they had longed for some positive event of magnitude to assure them that they had won. Their leader, sensing this desire for the spectacular, cautioned them, "There are many roads to ultimate victory, my brothers. Oro has many paths by which he can travel to triumph. Tomorrow, one of them will result in his final capture of Bora Bora, but you must not anticipate which one. That is up to Oro." With this, the high priest folded his hands, took off his skullcap, and inclined his head toward the inner sanctuary of Oro. His fellow priests did likewise, and in the deep silence of the night, dimly lit by distant fires and the glow of shimmering stars, the holy men prayed to their all-powerful God.
It was a solemn moment at the end of an exciting day. A moment sweet and meaningful, with the essence of immortality hovering above the assembly. The sacrifices in place, Great Oro brooding over his faithful, and all the world subdued in silent reverence to him. At such a moment, with the greatness of Oro pulsing in the night and throbbing in the veins more powerfully than the beat of a drum, it was incomprehensible to the priests that anyone should cling to old gods when the new deity was so powerful, so rational, and so benevolent. Next morning, Hero the steersman was up early, and with a sharp rock hidden in Tapa, he slashed several of the Senate strands that bound Wait for the West Wind together, shuddering with regret as he did so. Then, burying the rock, and hurrying to the priest in charge of the canoe's welfare to announce, "We must have scraped coral." The priest hurried to the canoe, which rested under the surveillance of the dead crewman lashed to the stern, and studied the broken Senet. "It can be mended with fresh cord," he said, hoping to get the accident repaired before the high priest blamed him for it. "Yes," the crewman agreed, "and we ought to do it while we are all under the protection of Oro." Such sentiment charmed the priest, and he was therefore receptive when Hero suggested, "Wouldn't it be easier to drag the canoe out here where the sun can tighten the new Senet?" And they edged the canoe into the exact position Tororo required. "Will the mending take long?" the priest asked. "No," Hero assured him. "I mustn't miss the convocation of Oro." "You must not," the priest agreed, recalling the high priest's assurances of the night before that on this day Oro would consolidate his victory over Bora Bora, and it seemed a good omen that Hero, one of Tororo's prominent supporters, had thus voluntarily signified his affection for Oro. The convocation began with a startling scene so that all who later reviewed the day agreed that it had been doomed from the beginning, although at the time that was not apparent, since the priests had quickly converted an error into a blessing. The assembly had seated itself on rocks stretching out from the main altar, and the first two pigs were being disemboweled when a boy of seven came running into the temple, crying for his father who sat near the altar. "Father!" the lost little child shouted. The man, a lesser chief of Hawaiki, looked in horror at the approach of his son, for the boy had committed so vast a sin that no excuse could pardon it. No woman, or child, or animal had ever strayed into the temple, and the father's arms trembled as he gathered the handsome little fellow to his heart. "I was looking for you, father," the lost child whimpered. In austere silence, the priests at the altar, their sacrifices to Oro interrupted, stared at the offending child. His father, aware of the taboo his family had broken, rose haltingly, with the boy still in his arms. Suddenly, in an act of total dedication, he thrust his son toward the altar, the child's hair falling over his father's strong left arm. With anguished but unfaltering conviction, the man spoke. "Take this child and sacrifice him to Oro, for the consecration of the temple has been broken by him. The thread of our union with Oro has been entangled. He is my son. I begat him. But I do not weep in losing him, for he has outraged Oro." At first, the priests ignored the man and left him standing with the boy in his arms, while with haughty indifference they finished slaughtering the pigs. Then, with fresh blood for Oro on their hands, two priests